So joining us this week on Amazing Avenue Audio, he's been on the show several times before. You know his work from For the Win at USA Today. Before that, you probably knew him from Ted Quarters and Mets Blog back in its heyday, I would say. But Ted Berg is with us. Ted, thanks for coming on.
Chris, thanks for having me.
So yeah, we'll just get right to it. You know, we talked about the trade that the Mets made as it was sort of happening on last week's episode. You know, we knew most of the details, but nothing was official yet. You know, so that we were a little bit ahead, but it was all pretty much on point in terms of where the trade was. But you were one of the people who I had seen out there on Twitter who was, you know, getting into the pro-Cano movement before the trade even really got anywhere near finalized.
Yeah, so. I mean, I guess, you know, I would say I've been, I think, part of a pro-Robinson Cano movement for like the last 15 years or something now, it feels like. You know, for whatever reason, the guy has always been sort of a divisive player. A guy, when he was with the Yankees, I think, sort of victim of like armchair body language expertise and people saying like, oh, this guy doesn't want to run hard. This guy doesn't want to, because he has a way of making things look so like almost like Carlos Beltran as an aesthetic player, where he makes things look so easy that people sort of say he's not trying very hard. And that's always rubbing the wrong way, just because if you look at the stats, like really there's just no more consistent player in the league. There's no one who's a better bet to play 155 games a season. And so to me, it's always sort of nuts that people would say you don't like playing baseball when meanwhile you're playing 161 games every year, right? Like you could bow out a few times and right. and not have to face that. So, so I was defending him. I guess I'm used to defending Cano, and as it pertains to the Mets specifically, I think a lot of the criticism I saw of the deal were, and some of it's fair, some of it's fair, right? He's old, he's 36, he's not going to be getting any better, and so a lot of people say, well, why would you want a 36-year-old? Why do we need a 36-year-old second baseman? But Cano, it's not like you're bringing back Asdrubal Cabrera, right? And no disrespect to him or Neil Walker. Cano is a Hall of Fame caliber talent, right? It's off the charts in terms of it's not just any old mid-30s acquisition. This is a really, really good player who was a really, really good player last year. He was a really, really good player after he came back from a suspension in a fairly small sample last season, and has really just hasn't been bad since like one lousy year, I think, in 2008. So the idea that he's going to just show up and completely fall apart because he's in his late 30s seemed ridiculous to me. And then the flip side of it, I guess, also is just the amount of love all of a sudden. And I know people love prospects and fans always overrate their home team's prospects, but you know, all of a sudden it seems like now Jared Kelenic and Justin Dunn climb from the bottom half of the most top 100 prospect lists to like can't miss the next coming of Trout and Clayton Kershaw.
Right. Yeah. So hitting on a few of those points, you know, the career arc for Cano sort of looks like what I'd imagine David Wright's would have looked like if his body hadn't, you know, essentially fallen apart for baseball purposes.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, you know, he's very consistent, very good. And like one of these guys who does everything really well and few things sort of exceptionally off the charts well. Like Cano is not going to hit 70 home runs. Wright wasn't going to hit 70 home runs, whatever. But just a great player, you know, and Cano, I think what was so baffling about the PED thing for me was with Cano was like, if I felt like if he didn't fail that test, he's a first ballot Hall of Famer, you know, even if he retired this year, I think he's there. I mean, just like the numbers are there for second baseman. There just haven't been a lot of guys at that position as good as he has been.
Right. And I mean, just thinking of a recent guy, relatively recent guy, you know, I like Craig Biggio. I don't have any problem with him getting into the Hall of Fame. That was fine with me. Cano is he's been better than that.
Pretty
substantially.
He is, you know, I think that he's like the third or fourth best active player, you know, and he's still got a few years to go in terms of WAR. I feel like I've been, every time I've written about Robinson Cano in my entire life, it has been defending him against something. And you know, maybe there's something to it. I guess there are aspects of his game that tend to irritate people. The PED thing certainly doesn't help, but he's a really great player. That's, you know, the bottom line is, and that's the thing is people will come around, and a lot of it will have to do with how the Mets play and if they win. And I think that, this deal, obviously you can't really look at it in a vacuum. I guess that's another aspect to it that I kind of like. Right, is if it was like a Marlins deal and the Mets were trading away all of their expensive salaries for nothing because they clearly wanted to, you know, reap revenue sharing money and profit off it, well, that's a deal you can be upset about. This is a deal that, for better or worse, and even if it blows up in their faces, it indicates that they earnestly want to win, right? And that hasn't always been obvious with the Mets. And you know, you can, I guess, criticize the way they're trying to go about it. But I think for Van Wagenen and for the front office, it sort of says like, okay, yeah, like we still believe this pitching staff has a championship in it. And we're going to put together, you know, the best team to win with DeGrom and Syndergaard and Wheeler and Mats within the next 2 or 3 years, because eventually these guys are going to leave.
Right, and even if they're able to extend DeGrom or Syndergaard or both, or if it's, you know, one or neither of them and it's Wheeler instead, you know, things change. But yeah, that acknowledgement that, you know, there are two options here. I mean, I think we all, well, I don't want to judge. I say this to other people all the time, so I don't want to judge the whole offseason after one move that I like. But you know, it's an acknowledgement that there's guys who are here now. We just saw what it looks like when Jacob DeGrom is the best pitcher on the planet and his team doesn't support not just him in terms of the win-loss record, but, you know, even being competitive as a team. So this acknowledgement that we have, you know, elite talent here with these guys, with him and Syndergaard, assuming they keep Conforto and Nimmo, you know, you have something here and you're going to add to it and try to make it better. And yeah, with Kelenic, I'm with you. You know, the way reactions were going as it was going on, I think they cooled off a little bit, maybe the next day.
The guy was like a pretty good hitter in rookie ball. You know, it's like if he's 4 months younger than Vlad Guerrero Jr. And that's not to knock him. I know he's a cold weather player, and you can say, okay, he's on a different sort of growth curve, and scouts love his natural hitting ability. There have been a lot of guys who have really earned the love of scouts with their natural hitting ability who have amounted to nothing. I think that the amount of information now available to us online sometimes hurts us in these departments, because you look through long enough, you're going to find some scout somewhere reported as raving about Kelenic, and that makes you paranoid, right? Because you don't now, sadly, once your team trades the guy away, now you're kind of rooting against him, right? And so you see the report that this guy is the greatest natural hitter in his class. And you think, oh, crap, now they traded Mike Trout. You know, this guy's going to be incredible. The odds say – I honestly think that there's a really good chance Cano gives the Mets more. Cano alone, without even factoring in Diaz, that Cano alone gives the Mets more than Kelenic and Dunn will do for their entire careers. Just because he's been that good of a player. He's like a 3.5 to 4 win player annually. And neither of those guys is a safe bet to even be a big league contributor at this point.
Right. And yeah, the way it was getting talked about in the moment, you know, I thought, well, I want to see him listed as a top 10 prospect in all of baseball. The way people are reacting,
again, like, everybody overrates their own team's prospects. And he is a guy who I think is more of a wild card than most, just because he is coming from Wisconsin and his had limited exposure in high school. And that's why I guess I keep bringing up Trout, because I think Trout sort of crept up on people that same way. Now, by the time Trout was Kelenic's age, I think he was the number two prospect in all of baseball. So if this guy was as good as people fear, and again, I'm not trying to crap on a 19-year-old who is playing rookie ball. He's obviously way better at baseball than me or anyone else I've ever met in my life, outside of the professional baseball players. but you just can't bet on it. You just can't bet. Like, he didn't even beat the crap out of rookie ball pitching, right? So it's a big stretch to say like, oh, this is a can't miss guy. But everybody listening to the Amazing Avenue podcast knows that. Right, because you're dealing in smart baseball fans here.
Yes, our listeners are very smart. I'd like all the ones I've met and who have written in have come from a good.
I'm not kidding. It's a smart baseball site, right? So you would hope that you would have smart listeners.
I'd like to think we do. But yeah, one thing that, you know, it certainly is getting framed as the Cano trade. But Diaz is, you know, relative to his peers, and Cano's still up there. I definitely agree with you on that. But relative to his peers, Diaz might actually be the best at his job. You know, Brody Van Wagenen introduces him at the press conference and says, here's the, you know, this is the best closer in baseball. And, you know, it's tough to make that claim as a GM and be able to point to stuff and back it up and say, hey, that might actually be true. So I'm just curious, you know, I know on the national level, you might have a little more exposure to some guys on the West Coast than we do, or even just from seeing the Mariners, even though it's only once a year, you know, when they come in to play the Yankees here in the Bronx. Have you had much chance to see Diaz pitch?
I mean, I've seen him mostly in highlights. I wind up watching, because I watch the Angels so much, I wind up watching a pretty good deal of AL West baseball, but usually not ninth inning AL West baseball, because I'm long asleep by then. So so most of what I've seen from Diaz is highlights and stats. But yeah, I mean, the stats are there, right? He's an elite 24-year-old closer. He's under team control for several more years. And I think a thing I think a lot of people are sort of missing on this one is, if he stays healthy, that value is not going away. And so, but right, because it's not like he's a rental player that you're taking on in the last year of his contract. He is an elite closer. He's young. He's under control. He's cheap. And so if this completely blows up in their face, right, and Cano is horrible, and, you know, DeGrom and Syndergaard both get hurt, they both need Tommy John, and they're both out through next year, and there's no chance they're going to win in the next two seasons, they can flip him at the deadline, and I feel like probably get a package of prospects back that's just as impressive as Dunn and Kelenic, right? So, like, I don't see – I feel like it's being painted as, okay, this means they're all in to win now. But Diaz isn't that, right? Because he is so young, and he is under team control for a while, so either he is – now you're closer, and you ink him in for the ninth inning, and he's got it for the next 4 years. Or if it looks like you're not going to really have a contender and you really do need a rebuild, then he is an agent of that rebuild, because you can definitely – I mean, teams we've seen, even after it seems like everyone knows you shouldn't pay too much for a reliever, teams are still doing it, right? Because – ultimately, it comes down to July, and you're looking at your bullpen, and you need a guy to lock down the final innings for the postseason. You're going to blink and spend too much to get that guy. So I feel like their hedge here is that they can always just flip him way down the road.
Yeah, and that's especially the way bullpen use has gotten, you know, in the playoffs over the last few years. You know, you're in a spot where people, even if they have one or two good guys, could definitely find him appealing, either as their best or second best option. So, that's certainly valid. You know, one of the things that I've heard a couple times, and I heard it, I didn't hear all of the group interview of Francesa talking to Van Wagenen, Mickey Callaway, and Jeff Wilpon, but something Francesa brought up that I had seen somewhere else that I don't remember where, but it was, oh, are you concerned about the mileage on Cano? He's played so many games. And it's like, what? I thought guys playing a lot of games was a good thing. You know, that's right. Something we praise guys for.
Right. It's like, oh, so they should bring in AJ Pollock because he's got his legs are rested because he's missed half a season the last three straight years. Right. Yeah.
Right.
No, I mean, Cano has been, he was injured when he got popped for the PEDs last year, but that was really the first injury of his career. You know, he's been a remarkably healthy player. And so that's good, you know, and I feel like that also speaks to a guy's ability to hold up into his late 30s, right? If he had been someone whose whole career had been marred by injuries from the time he's 26, it's maybe one story. And if he's a guy who has been healthy and consistent, then, you know, you have to hope he does hold up. I don't know. It feels like people were painting it. And everyone I spoke to was like, oh, you have to take on Cano to get Diaz. It's like, well, it's not it's not that this guy is simply an albatross contract that you're accepting. This is a really good player who is making slightly too much money.
Right. And I think part of the thing with the Mets too, and you know, you always have to be apprehensive about what they're going to spend, but they were at a spot where after the next two seasons, they literally didn't have any money guaranteed to anybody. So even the Mets, even with Cano on the books, you know, if we go through the bad scenario that you laid out, you know, they don't, excuse me, sinuses this time of year are the best. But if they go through all that and they don't contend, they trade Diaz away for prospects, they could still end up having a payroll that's well under $100 million in 2021 if they were really in like a full rebuild mode, you know? So it's
I hope it never comes to that.
No,
right?
Me
like
too.
You don't want to see the Mets spending less than $100 million on payroll. But yeah, you're right. I mean, right? It's not even like a, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like this is the type of deal, especially when you're getting $20 million in relief and you're getting Jay Bruce off your books. Like, this should not be a deal. It might, or they might point to it as a deal that hamstrings them down the road because it's the Mets. But in any, like, logical real-world scenario, 5 years and $100 million for Robinson Cano should not hamstring a team playing in the largest market in the country. It just shouldn't. You know, it's just I get that he – I don't think he would make that if you were a free agent now. But I think you'd get 4 and 60, right? I think you might get 4 and 70, something like that, even coming after off the PEDs. I was seeing that framed as like, oh, Cano wouldn't get more than 3 and 30. And I don't buy that either. He was worth $30 million last year, basically.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's absurd. You know, I don't know. Maybe it's because, and I've been saying this for a couple of years, maybe it's because I'm in my 30s now that I, you know, I'm more like, I'm here to defend.
You're like, 36? That's not old. That's not old. Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah. And I get it. Like, I know, you know, I know how it is in this sport and really all of them. But I think it generally holds true that, you know, guys who are elite talents like this tend to age better. You know, not every single one of them does, but, you know, the way Mike Trout is playing at the age he is now, I will not be shocked if he's still way better than most players in the league when he's 36, you know?
I mean, like Adrian Beltre is a good comp, right? And he was just, I know he just retired, but he was still an above average player and he's 39 years old. You know, like you can hope for the next 3 years. Like, I think $24 million a year, which is what they're paying for Cano, in terms of, and it's not what they're paying. They're paying him $20 million, right? If you include the salary relief. That's not much more than you should pay for an average big league regular. And I think he's going to be an above average big league regular for like at least the next 3 years. And then maybe he declines to being like just okay. And you kind of have to eat it on the back end of the deal. But that's every deal. I don't know. It just doesn't seem like it just seems like a, like where I see Cano and the money left on his deal versus public perception was just like a massive divide. And so probably I'm wrong. But I don't know.
I'd like to. I hope you're right because I'm with you on this, and most things really when it comes to baseball.
Good.
But yeah, no, it sets them up, you know. So in that interview that they did that went on forever, you know, I didn't watch it.
I just kept seeing people on Twitter like, believe it or not, this Mets interview is still going on with Francesco. Like, I didn't see a minute of it, but I understand it was extremely long.
Yeah, and you know, overall, it was, from what I heard, I listened to a little bit of it at work, and like only a minute or two after I, you know, got in my car. But it was not really hard hitting questions most of the time. You know, a lot of stuff that you had already heard about, you know, a variety of topics, especially this trade, you know, the insurance money for Cespedes and Wright and all that. A lot of things that were covered on the day of the press conference. And then the only things that at least kind of got me interested were questions about, you know, Harper and Machado. And basically, I'm forgetting now already if it was Jeff Wilpon. I think it was Jeff Wilpon himself who said that, you know, Brody knows the framework to work within. And I think Van Wagenen said...
No, I don't.
The line, yeah. he said we'd have to get really creative to you know, to make one of those guys work. So with the way the roster stands, and if we assume the Mets are not going to make a run at Machado or Harper, which I think we all
assume. There's no way, right? There's no way. I don't think there's any way they can, like, unless it's open season again, then I don't see how someone's not going to give those guys way more money than the Mets can give them.
Right. So, yeah, if we assume that, you mentioned AJ Pollock. He was one of the names who, you know, has come up recently. But with him or anybody else who's out there, you know, is there anybody else who you love for the Mets as the next move or two?
I mean, so, you know, there's now the rumor is that they're going to trade Nimmo or Rosario, or Nimmo and Rosario for JT Realmuto. I assume you've seen that.
Yeah. Yes.
I hate it. I just, and that's like pure, like, that's a lack of reason. But like, how do you trade Brandon Nimmo? Are you serious? Have you seen this guy? Like, have you not seen this man smile? Like, you have to keep him. You have to keep him. He's too lovable, right? Like, that is just, to me, a straight-up troll move. If you're like, hey, everyone loves this guy, good news. We're going to trade him for an older player. And I also fear that once you start getting into that, like, it's like, oh, the Mets are going to be a team that, like, makes 17 trades this offseason and signs all the big free agents. Then you're looking at, like, the Padres of 3 years ago, where it's like, okay, like, you won the offseason. Your team didn't really get that much better, and now you've basically screwed yourself for like 7 years moving forward because you got involved in all of these like sort of lousy free agent deals on behalf of winning now. I don't think the Cano deal and bringing Cano and Diaz prevents them from creating like a sustainable winning franchise. I think it moves the timeline forward a little bit and maybe makes it a little bit difficult on the backside because of giving up Kelenic and Dunn. But I think if you start talking about trading Nimmo and trading Conforto and sort of going all in, Realmuto is only under contract for the next 2 years, right? So then you're limiting your window. Then you're saying, okay, it's by the end of 2020 that we better contend because now we just gave up, you know, whether it's Nimmo or Conforto, a really good major league outfielder who's under control for the next 4 years. And so I hate that type of move. Like, I don't think they should be looking to part with any of their young big leaguers. I think you got to set the window at like next 3-4 years, not just like, oh, we're going to win immediately, because I think that's unfeasible. And I think then if one guy gets hurt, especially a guy on the pitching staff, then that just all falls apart.
Yeah. And
so it doesn't answer your question. Clearly, it seems like they need a catcher. I don't know how much you can trust Arno at this point to stay healthy. Plawecki had moments, you know, like, I don't know. Grandal is a guy. It's like, you know, joining now Robinson Cano, you're just going to bring in all of the least popular dudes from around the league. But Grandal's a really good catcher, you know, and a guy who's been a great defensive player, a great pitch framer, and a really, really good hitter for a catcher that I think still has some life left. And I think when you talk about free agents like that, then, you know, yeah, you're going to lose something. And I believe he did get the did they give him a qualifying offer, Grandal? Do you know?
Yeah, they did, and he turned it down.
So you're going to give up the draft picks to get him, and that stinks. But I would rather – I think everyone who's ever seen Brandon Nimmo smile would rather give up a draft pick than Brandon Nimmo to get a pretty good catcher. And so, you know, I would like to see them pursue the free agent route there. I don't know. I kind of want to wait and see and see how Van Wagenen goes about it. I liked the Cano move in isolation and Diaz. But now that there's ensuing talk, it makes me a little nervous. Like that it's like, okay, let me just reshape this team in my image and make a bunch of moves for the sake of making moves and not necessarily make the best moves.
Right. Yeah, no.
But that's probably paranoia. And it could just be that a lot of things get reported.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And it certainly seems like there are, you know, there's no shortage –
You can't trade Brandon Nimmo. You just can't trade Brandon Nimmo. Don't trade Brandon Nimmo. Don't do it. Just don't do it.
Yeah, I think you are preaching to the choir in terms of the audience here. You know, it's I don't know. To me, I'd bring back Curtis Granderson for similar reasons, and the fact that he was still pretty useful last year or this year.
Yeah, kind of good.
But yeah, Real Muto. He's awesome.
Really good player.
If I had confidence that they would go get Harper, then sure, I could give up Conforto for Real Muto and, you know, bring in Harper. And all of a sudden,
Harper's a better bet than Conforto. Harper wasn't even that much better than Conforto last year, you know, I would be wary of, like, giving up the cheap guys to have like expensive replacements who are not that much better.
I like it. Right? That's a bold take. I like it though.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a bold take. I don't know.
Harper Conforto thing.
Harper. I mean, it's true. Like Harper was pretty good. You know, like he's a really right. patient hitter. He gets on base a lot, but like he's not a perfect offensive baseball player. He's been hurt a bunch of times. He's prone to striking out. He's prone to big slumps. And Machado is a different situation, I think, because I think Machado is a more valuable player just because he can play defense, because he can do a lot of different things. I'm not trying to say Michael Conforto is as good as Bryce Harper. I'm just saying he's not so much worse that, like, the difference between whatever you're going to pay Conforto in arbitration, which is going to be like $6 million or something, and the $36 million a year you might have to give Bryce Harper, I don't think Harper is $30 million better than Conforto. And so I don't feel like that's the right way to go about upgrading your team.
Right. Well, yeah, no, that makes sense. And I, not trying to detract from Harper, but a lot of times because of the hype that surrounded him and the fact that he's been successful in the major leagues, you know, he gets talked about it like he's up there with Trout, and it just hasn't happened.
It's laughable to compare him to Trout. It's unfair to both of them. Right. You know, I feel like it's just mean to Bryce Harper to be like, hey, you're almost as good as Mike Trout, because he's just not. And it's like, and like, this guy might be a Hall of Famer, but the longer you compare him to Mike Trout, the worse he's going to look, because he's just nowhere close.
Right. So, you know, with that said, he's a very good player. You know, he's still young enough that he could develop further in terms of either power or you know, just learning the game.
So is Conforto, for the record, right? So is
right.
Conforto.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely.
I think they're basically the same age.
So, yeah, that general way of approaching it, just signed Grandal.
You'll have to excuse the autoplay video on Bryce Harper's baseball reference page.
Yes, of course. But yeah, no, it's certainly reasonable to want to keep those guys and just sign some players. You know, with where they are now, it's, and Real Muto, I feel like, I don't know, he's definitely really good, definitely, I would say, the best all-around catcher in baseball right now. One of the very few who can hit, and so is Grandal. But, you know, you look at it, and if the Marlins price remains really, really high and nobody meets it and they go into the season and they still have this guy who is, you know, coming to work and playing in the uniform and just hating every second of it because he wants out of there. I don't know. Maybe not just the Mets, but maybe other teams can wait the Marlins out a little bit and try to lower the price, you know, get into the season and look at it from there.
I mean, he's coming off the best season of his career offensively. He's a, like you said, he's a really good player. I don't know. I'm like, on one hand, there are so few good hitting catchers, like you said, that it's like, okay, so maybe this is the guy who's worth going for. But on the other hand, the reason there are so few good hitting catchers is that teams move the good hitters off catcher because they don't want to risk them. And so you know, going like sort of spending big on a offensive minded catcher, there's a lot of risk involved in that, right? Because it's just a position where guys get hurt all the time. And so I don't know. Like you said, if you wait them out and the price is right and you don't have to give up 1 to 2 major league ready young players, then great. You know, go. I mean, he's an awesome player, but you can't just don't trade Nimmo. Just don't do it. That's my thing. It's just I don't know. Just don't do it.
I like it. Let's see. So shifting away from you know, the off season a little bit, it's obviously been exciting. You know, we for us, it's been nice. We haven't had to like write a bunch of free agent profiles of guys who the Mets are never going to sign, because there's actually some stuff going on. You know, they make a big move. There's enough rumors. It's been a little more fulfilling than usual for this stage of the off season, from like the, you know, how the Amazing Avenue sausage is made process. But looking back, you know, you've gotten to still, despite, you know, having a broader scope with baseball, you've still gotten to see a lot of the Mets. Any particular moments, either, you know, whether it was DeGrom or David Wright's final game, that, you know, you were at Citi Field or at a game on the road that you saw them, that stuck out from this season?
I was at Wright's final game. I was also at I thought the press conference with Wright was actually like a little bit sadder than the game. I thought the game was more like, well, a little bit weird than anything else. Just, I don't know. And like, David Wright deserved it, and I'm happy that he was able to get back out on the field and do that. And I think if there's a single player who merits that treatment, like, he is that guy, just because I think he's like one of the world's best people, basically, like from everything you can figure out. But it did feel like a little bit of a farce, you know, that like, oh, like this guy who can't play baseball anymore, we're just going to let play baseball for a few innings. You know, it had a little bit of like a sort of circus element to it that I didn't love. Like, I feel like probably Wright didn't really absolutely love that necessarily either. I don't know. Whereas the press conference, I thought, seemed like so genuinely emotional, and I just felt so bad for the dude. And like that, I don't know. Like I said at the time, like the one time, like if you look back throughout David Wright's career, like the only times he ever got mad were when people were like, oh, you have to come out of this baseball game. And right. Like that was it. That was the only thing he wanted to do, was just play baseball. And now, like, to be 35 years old and your body is like, oh, no, sorry, you can't play baseball anymore. Like, what a rough deal. You know, like, what a crappy draw in life to get that. And like, he's this guy who's, he'll say, like, you know, don't pity him. And I get it. Like, he's filthy rich and he has this lovely family and he's been able to play baseball for so long. But, like, I don't care. That sucks, man. Like, that, you know, to have such a good career end that way. No matter what spoils he's gotten from it, it still kind of sucks. And I think, you know, he I'm sure feels that way too. So I thought that was, I don't know, that moved me more than I think anything that happened on the field this year. And it was also, you know, Jay Harwood's leaving, like Jay was there and he seemed pretty emotional at that night. And that kind of made me a little sad too. Just seeing, you know, it's like, I'm away from it now, but there's so much more to an organization, a baseball team, than just ultimately like the games on the field. And there is this sort of family culture to it. And, you could sense the connection that everyone had to David Wright in the room, and seeing all his teammates come in, and several of those guys had tears in their eyes, and how shaken they seemed by the press conference, and then seeing, you know, the Mets employees who deal with him and how emotional they were. It really hurt. It was sad. It was like, it was a sad day. Even, you know, for as much as it led to this like lovely celebration of his career, it's a sad way for his career to end, for sure.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to make that game, and I wasn't at the press conference, but you know, I think in terms of the overall feel of sort of celebrating his career and everything, I feel like a number retirement ceremony might feel a little more natural than that last game.
Yeah, and I got to imagine that'll come, right? Like, how could they not?
Yeah, no, you never know. They could find a way to screw it up, but...
Yeah, I mean, you know, I thought all things considered, considering it's the Mets, like, I didn't think they handled it all that poorly. In rights, you know, like, it was like, they gave him, you know, like, clearly what he was working, at some point it became that he was working to try to get back on the field so he could go out on his own terms. They gave him that opportunity. People got, I remember, like, now it's like, fading in the mirror already. I remember like people got upset that they didn't let him talk after a game before he played or whatever. I don't know. Like I think if you're from a fan's perspective, like he got his moment at the press conference to sort of say his piece. He got his opportunity to go out on the field and tip his cap and say goodbye. And I think that given the circumstances, the money owed and the way it ended and how bad the team was, like, I thought that was a pretty sunny way for the Mets to have hand. Like, obviously, like, the situation sucks. I don't think the Mets made it any worse other than whatever they did to probably, like, ruin him in physical capacity years ago. You know, like, I think in terms of 2018 and David Wright and leaving the game, I think it went about as smoothly as they could have hoped.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's... That's for sure. And hopefully the concept and execution of a number retirement would go well. So yeah, that's David Wright is never the wrong answer. I don't think when it comes to good Mets moments.
You know, at the beginning there, it was like, wow, man, this team's going to be incredible. They keep having all these comeback wins. Right. And then that soured swiftly, you know? And so, I mean, other than that, there weren't a lot of great moments that stood out of that season, right? Like that just, you know, obviously DeGrom.
Right.
And, you know, Nimmo, like I said, sort of emerging as a player, and Zach Wheeler having a really nice year. Like there are some glimmers for optimism. But it was not a great season. You know, it was a pretty brutal one.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately. Hopefully, whatever happens, hopefully it's not that long before we're closer to a 2015 experience than a 2018
right.
experience.
And hey, Jeff McNeil was good. That was cool.
Yeah. No, it's...
They managed to find 230 at-bats for Jose Reyes.
They sure
that was,
did.
That was cool.
I'm curious because when one of the things you were tweeting about when the Cano stuff was, you know, in the works, about to go down, was that McNeil might be in it. So I
heard that. I mean, that was one of the rumors at some point, but you know, I didn't, it wasn't like something that I, like, I don't report on this stuff. I don't pursue trade rumors. I just think, well, why don't I just wait and find out what happens? You know, like I would be much better at my job if I were digging up scoops, but, seems like a lot of effort for, you know, knowing 10 minutes before it actually happens. But yeah, I mean, mostly it was just that a lot of the sentiment about Cano was like, oh my God, you can't block Jeff McNeil. And like, I loved watching him. Jeff McNeil, hopefully he's awesome. He's the type of player, I think, you know, like I love the sort of older prospect who was never really a hot commodity and hit his way up and finally gets a chance. I love that guy. Like that, that profile is one that certainly very much appeals to me, like a TJ Rivera before him. But right. It's just like pump the brakes. The guy has 60 games or whatever it is. And you're saying like, oh, but like you can't bring in Hall of Famer Robinson Cano because Jeff McNeil is there. There's playing time for both of these guys, right? Like you're going to be able to find ways to get Jeff McNeil on the field. It sounds like they're going to use him at third and no one's going to be able to complain all that much. But like, you know, how many times have we seen guys have nice 60 game starts to their careers and suddenly you're building the future around them and then they wind up not really panning out. And again, I'm rooting for Jeff McNeil. I'm just saying you gotta allow for the chance that this guy is not, you know, Mike Schmidt now as the third baseman or pick a Hall of Fame second baseman as a second baseman. There's always a really strong chance of regression, especially with guys who sort of arrive out of nowhere. And he had a great season in AAA last year as well. And there's some hitting in his past, but it's not like this guy was, you know, 1,000 OPS every single season in the minors. He came together late. Hopefully he stays this good. It's not a guarantee, obviously.
Right. Yeah, no, that's all fair for sure. And it's nice to have it, at least for now. It's a situation where he's sticking around and, you know, we've seen how seasons go. It's not just the Mets, even if it is maybe the Mets a little more than average, but playing time will open up.
Right. It's very rare when you're like, oh, we just have too many good players. Right. And it just does not happen very often.
Right. And it's rare to just get through a season with any four guys. I mean, you group the infield together because they're all infielders, but if you were to just pick four guys on a roster and say, oh yeah, those guys are going to be healthy and good all year, you know, it's hard to do. Those late 90s infields, sure, you know, I feel like Olerud, Alfonso, Ordonez, and Ventura played a pretty solid, you know, I don't recall, my memory might be off, but I don't recall any of them getting hurt for a significant amount of time in those couple of years when they were, like, really good.
Yeah, I think also something that's changed since that time is, like, it was weird. Like, baseball trended toward specialization for so long. That, and now it seems to be sort of going back the other way. And so you do get guys like, Ben Zobrist is sort of the classic example because he was at the front of it. But now it seems like a lot of teams figure out ways to move guys around and even superstars, right? Like Chris Bryant and Alex Bregman are not too big to be locked into one position and that's the one they play. So if Jeff McNeil is going to be a guy who has a 900 OPS like he did in last season, you're going to find a bat for him. Even if you have Cano and even if Alonso's good and even if Rosario's good, even if you bring in a third baseman, you know, like you can move guys around. I think that the league-wide mentality has changed a little bit toward like, hell, like it's just, you know, catching the ball and throwing the ball, I'll stand wherever. Right. And I think the shifts have probably made that easier a bit as well. So, you know, if a guy can hit, they're going to find at bats for him. And that's true of McNeil, whether or not they've got Robinson Cano on the team.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I guess on the non-baseball side of things, did you encounter, what's the best new sandwich you encountered over the last year? were there several?
So I think the one that jumps to my head is actually a burger. at there's a it's a growing series of restaurants. Emily and like Pizza Loves Emily or Emmy Squared is one. It's like a family, but their burger is a sort of a double stacked patty with their special sauce and onions. It's like and on a pretzel bun. It sounds very straightforward. You have to see the thing. It looks so beautiful that I was skeptical of it because I was like, I think that they made this for Instagram and that there's no way this tastes as good as it looks. And then I went there and it absolutely tastes as good as it looks. And so that was the best sandwich. That was the best sandwich I've had in a really long time. Like it was an eye opener. I've been back there a couple times since. I would like to go more often. It's sadly not terribly close to my apartment. But yeah, that was the sandwich that jumps out for 2018. And then I was able – so over the summer, I was able to chase down World Cup foods in the New York area. I wound up eating – it was like part of our World Cup coverage was just me going to different places in Queens and finding the food of different World Cup countries and ate really well through that adventure too. Like there was some good Senegalese food. It turns out it was delicious. And really enjoyed, so Peruvian style Chinese food is a thing where that you can get in Queens, obviously, but like Chinese food is extremely popular in Peru. There are a lot of Chinese, ethnically Chinese people living in Peru. But obviously the way the Chinese food has evolved in Peru is different than the way it did in China and the way it did in the US. And so I sort of love that you can go in New York and find like this very specific subset of Chinese food, right, which is Chinese food via Peru. And it turns out to be delicious because you can get the Peruvian green sauce and pour that on top of your Chinese food. So that's a strong recommendation for the people looking around. And, you know, you can eat all of these things before or after Mets games, which I often did.
Yeah, you know, that's a definite bonus. I do wish, you know, you look at the way the schedule has been made over the last few years, and when it first shifted from Saturday games being, you know, night games instead of day games, I was kind of like, yeah, whatever, that's fine. And now, I don't even think it's that I'm getting older. It's just it's been that way for a while, and I'm fine with the game on a Saturday night ending at any time. But it's kind of nice to have, like, a 1 o'clock game where you could go do something else in Queens, you know.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, like, eating, like, Queens has got to be one of the most interesting places, like, literally on the entire planet, just because I think it is the most ethnically diverse place in the world, right, or among them.
Yeah, as far as I know, it's certainly still up there, and it may still have that title.
And like, right around, it's funny, like, you're always sort of presented with this notion of like of Citi Field being in a junkyard, and to some extent that's true. But like, it's like a half a mile from Citi Field, and you're in the middle of Main Street in Flushing, which is like some just like this incredible like explosion of cultures, mostly like Asian cultures, and tons of delicious Chinese food, and I've had Malaysian food there. And then you go the other way and you're in Corona, and it's a lot of different Latin foods and like there's so much to eat and so many different people. And I don't know, like while Citi Field itself is very isolated, it's just not that far to get to like really cool parts of Queens. Now I feel like I'm working for the Queensboro president or something, but I've been riding my bike to games the last couple of years, and it really opens up like a whole world that I just didn't even really know about as someone who would get on the 7 train, get off at Citi Field, and get right back on and come home.
Right. Yeah. I'm trying to think if I have anything else. We touched on a lot of good stuff here. How's Taco Bell doing? I think that's a mandatory question before I let you go.
rapidly expanding in New York City, which is exciting. I'm a little hesitant to note that like the newest one near my apartment, I have been to twice, And both times there were more people working there than people waiting for food. And both times I wound up waiting like 15 to 20 minutes for my food. And so like, that's a sort of a bad sign for me. Like, it's like, oh, like, I, you know, like, what's the point of Taco Bell if you're not going to get your food immediately?
Right.
So I don't know if it's just like some hiccups getting off the ground there or what it is. I would like for all of the Taco Bells to run optimally. I got so excited about the new Taco Bell near my apartment, and then so far it has been a little bit of a letdown, if I'm being honest.
Yeah. Well, hopefully there's room for improvement there.
I believe they'll get there.
Yeah, it's
Taco Bell. If Taco Bell has shown me one thing, it's that they're committed to getting me Taco Bell.
Yeah. Yes. Well, on that note, thank you again, Ted, for joining us this week, and you know, it's always a pleasure. We'll try to have you on some more during the season. Hopefully, we'll have things to celebrate about the Mets, and yeah, as always, you can find Ted on Twitter at OG Ted Berg, his work at For the Win, which is on USA Today's site. It's forthewin.com, right?
FTW.USALay.com.
Okay, all right.
I don't think it's forthewin.com. I don't know why not yet, but hopefully. But that's like the – we still don't – SNY is still working on SNY.com, I think. So, you know, sometimes right. These things take a while.
Right. Yeah. Understandable.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey everybody, this is Steve Seiper, and a few weeks ago I was talking about the Arizona Fall League and what we could take away from how the players at the Mets sent did, and I left off talking about Pete Alonso, and Robinson Cano, Edwin Diaz trade happened, so last week is kind of crazy, and obviously that took priority, but now that things have calmed down a bit from that front, I want to go back to that, especially since the new GM is apparently pretty high on Alonso, and he said that there's a very good chance that he's the starting first baseman when the season starts next year. So just to refresh, Alonso didn't commit a single error in 27 games with the Scottsdale Scorpions during the AFL season. He has the reputation of not being a good defender, and going errorless in 27 games isn't going to change that. And I want to go into just a little more detail about what I mean by him not being a good defender, because if the Mets do decide to promote him and they make him the primary first baseman going forward, it's not like every play at first base is going to be adventure. I mean, it kind of will be, but let me explain. Alonso is playable at first base, and not everything that he does is bad. He's on the bigger side. He's 6'4", 250 pounds, but it's not like he's fat. He carries it well. He's athletic for a 6'4", 250-pound guy. And he has solid range at first, and he played third base a lot in college, and he has an arm that fits at third. So even though it's not really something that's going to get featured too much at first, he does have a strong arm when he needs it. The biggest problem with Alonso is that he has, I don't know what to call it, the defensive yips, the Daniel Murphy yips, something. He just makes defensive miscues and errors that leave you scratching your head sometimes. He'll bungle things that come naturally to like a little league kid, or your 40-year-old out-of-shape uncle that's super gung-ho about softball, even though he's not really good at it. Some of these things I've seen on MILB TV. Others are just the stories that are kind of floating around out there. But there's been instances of him misreading fly balls, like can of corn kind of fly balls. There have been instances of him misreading basic grounders and rushing and screwing up his footwork or glove work, things like that. Something interesting about those defensive yips that he gets, and this is something that me and Jeff and Lucas and the newest member of our minor league team, Kenny, were talking about a while ago. A lot of it seems to be on plays that he has time to think about what he's doing. I remember seeing him make a great play at Trenton over the summer. It was like a hard cue shot by some Trenton batter that he just made a great leap for. It wasn't like a loopy hit. It was like a solid line drive at him, and he just kind of made the instinctual jump, and he got the out. And then there's stories about him missing tosses from the pitcher or the catcher on, like, little squibblers that barely get out of the box. So, not last year, but the year before, when he was with St. Lucie, he had that monster second half, And one of the things that he attributed to was working with Chad Kroeder and hitting coach Louis Nattera. I have the MILB article up here in front of me. And one of the things that he had said specifically was that they helped him with the mental aspect of the game. He said things like, quote, I had to compartmentalize to get my mind off the struggles. And here's a long one, quote, mentally, I'm a tough son of a bitch. After I hurt my hand, I was hitting 150-something at one point, and that was incredibly difficult on me, but I finished at 286. It was rough. Not only was it the injury, but I was struggling even after coming back. After the All-Star break, I had to claw my way back one step at a time. Whether I did well or poorly, I had to flush it. Make each game its own thing. Isolate it. I can't think about hitting 300 when I have a game that day. But once I got rolling, there's a kind of desperation to show all that was past me. So, for whatever reason, the mental stuff was affecting him when it came to the bat. And he was able to get over that. He quieted his doubts and the voices in his head, and he's been like a 280 hitter ever since. And I'm not trying to be an armchair psychologist or anything, but I wonder if the same exact stuff is holding him back defensively. In that same interview, he said that his defense is generally making a plan by thinking about the plays that's happening and then going and doing that. So maybe he's getting in his head and thinking too much. Again, he's passable to solid. He has passable to solid physical tools. And he's been playing the position for a long enough time that he should, you know how the position works, what you need to do. And he makes those reaction plays just fine. Maybe he just thinks about it too much, just like he was when he was struggling with the bat, and he gets in his own way. Whatever the case may be, though, barring a trade, we're going to see him in Queens next season, be it opening day, or a few weeks into the season, or June, or something. And the bat is pretty good, and the power is off the charts, and we know that offense isn't going to be a problem. So hopefully his defense will be something that the team can live with, and he's not, you know, destined to be like a full-time DH somewhere in the American League. I've liked Alonso since day one, since the day he was drafted, and I would definitely like to see him with the Mets for a while, and I'm sure that everybody out there agrees.